This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Twin Peaks, The Final Dossier by Mark Frost. Read for you by Annie Wershing. Federal Bureau of Investigation, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Interoffice Memorandum. Date, September 6, 2017. From Tamara Preston, Special Agent. To Gordon Cole, Deputy Director. Dear Director Cole, pursuant to your directive to me upon the completion of my investigation into the archivist dossier last year, I hereby submit my subsequent follow-up report. That archive, which ended abruptly on March 28, 1989, with the Major's sudden disappearance and presumed death, left us with many possible avenues of investigation. As you suggested to me at the time, I have since directed my own investigation down every rabbit hole and up every apple tree in search of answers. To state it more plainly, I'm the archivist now. Unlike the previous dossier, where for the most part all documents were presented to us in their entirety per Bureau standards, here I have taken the time to condense the relevant content I found into an uninterrupted narrative. As you also requested, I began this project in the town of Twin Peaks itself by attempting to bring you up to date on the stories of many of the town's residents, many of whom you yourself knew personally, over the intervening decades. I learned much that was surprising. Your words, "these woods are full of secrets," come immediately to mind as a distinct understatement. And many other things reflecting the startling rate of change any community, small or large, faces over the course of a quarter century of recorded history. The pace of change is extremely hard to perceive at close range. It's virtually invisible day to day, but viewed from a distance, it moves like lightning. The trials and trivialities of daily life, I've concluded, act on the mind as a kind of local anesthetic, numbing us to the relentless passage and ravages of time. I've also learned, a humbling admission to be sure, to view this effect as a kind of mercy. My conclusions and takeaways from this part of the journey, which you also requested of me, I have included from time to time when they apply throughout the document, rather than offering them as a preamble, as I don't want to shade your perceptions prior to your first read. On a personal level, I will share with you, however, that regardless of the cost to my innocence or naivete regarding these truths of the human condition, which I now freely acknowledge at the start was considerable, I emerge from this experience grateful for the wisdom it has given me, and stronger of mind for the hard lessons learned. May I also state that your faith in me to undertake this task, and the opportunity you've provided for me to contribute to the collective work that still lies ahead of us, remains one of the authentic blessings of my life. I only hope that in whatever small way I can, I'm able to apply my shoulder to that wheel for as long as time and fate allow. Most respectfully yours, Tamara Preston, Field Agent, Blue Rose Task Force. The Addendum. This first document is, as you'll quickly learn, not exactly a traditional autopsy report. I assume this was made accessible to you at the time of the incident as a Blue Rose file, but since it was not passed along through traditional Bureau channels and hardly embraces standard forensic formatting, I am including it in the pursuit of thoroughness. Autopsy Report, Calhoun Memorial Hospital. Examination reference number 1989-0401, Johnson, Leo Abel. On the morning of April 1, 1989, an autopsy was completed on the body of Leo Abel Johnson. Visible injuries, 5 gunshot wounds, numerous spider bites, electrical burns, bruises, cigarette burns. Internal injuries, bullet lodged near spine. Damage to sinus cavity. Anatomical summary. A. 5 gunshot wounds to upper thoracic. B. Arachnid bites, tarantula, theraphosidae. C. Electrical burn marks. D. Cigarette burns. E. Bruising. F. Bullet lodged internally near lower lumbar, third vertebrae. Cause of death, 5 gunshot wounds, A. External injuries male, front and back. Date and signature of examiner, Special Agent Albert Rosenfield. It's not often I'm tempted to begin one of these suggesting he made the world a better place by taking early retirement, but in this case I'm willing to make an exception. My own interaction with this knuckle-dragger was fleeting, but he left a vivid impression, not unlike the livid marks on his soon-to-be ex-wife's neck after he nearly strangled her. His entire lifespan could easily be written off as a scathing indictment of our public education system, but to be fair, you'd probably have to go all the way back to the crossroads where Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal went their separate ways and say, Leo's forebears took the path less traveled. So for starters, it wasn't the spiders that killed him. Whatever evil genius, I'm looking at you, Windermere, decided to hoist a bag of tarantulas over his head as a dire threat to Leo's health, obviously wasted far too much time watching cheesy Vincent Price movies and not nearly enough time studying arachnids. Tarantulas aren't ever fatally venomous, dipshit. They just look scary. I'm going to go out on another limb and conclude that the 5 gunshots to his upper thoracic area had slightly more to do with the late lamented Johnson's tragic demise. Patterned in a punctilious little circle around his heart with one to grow on dead center. Unfortunately, aside from the killer, it appears that said spiders were the only witnesses. Observations. The 5 9mm slugs were all still in the body. He had, I'll put it delicately, an excess of mass to help slam on the brakes, and there were no powder burns on his clothes or skin. Ergo, shot from across the room by someone with a low pulse and nifty marksmanship skills. Scuff marks near the door where it appears the shooter set his feet bureau style. Just a working theory because who the hell knows where he shuffled off to, but my money's all on our old pal Wyndham. Also, circular pattern of electrical burn marks around Leo's neck. A canine shock collar on the floor nearby, sized for a St. Bernard. Nice, Leo must have made a first-rate slippers fetcher. Massive bruising over most of the body, cigarette burns, signs of malnutrition, even traces of birthday cake in his hair. I'm guessing these weren't all the residue of occupational hazard as a long-haul trucker. Wyndham enjoyed a lot of fun with the poor bastard. On the other hand, the damage to his nasal passages and sinus cavities, which looked like a depleted uranium mine, 80% of the cartilage scorched or burned away, appear to be entirely self-inflicted. Like the commercial almost says, things go better with crystal meth. That goes double if you're trying to keep your eyes peeled all night while hauling a load of cheap mattresses from Boise to Bishop. This interested me. Leo also had a bullet lodged near the 3rd vertebrae of his lower lumbar spine. Conclusion. This is an early injury from a different weapon, from a .22 caliber, for which he had been treated some weeks earlier at the local hospital. The IC resident's diagnosis from that time noted Leo was suffering from paralysis of the extremities, but concluded that once surrounding inflammation subsided, he might, and apparently did, recover the use of his limbs, if not his senses. So, you might as well ask, who shot Leo the first time? According to the jacket meticulously assembled on our hero by, as they charitably refer to them here in East Rubesville, local law enforcement, Leo evolved from consumer to trafficker at some point in his sunset years. Going by the peek I took inside his cranium, impairment of moral judgment would have been the least of his symptomatic responses. He'd clearly suffered a cerebral hemorrhage within his last few weeks of life, but I'll spare you the clinical verbiage. Chief, his brain looks like a dog's breakfast, if your dog liked garbage with his scrambled eggs. With his sudden departure, Leo Johnson left little behind aside from his badly used Corvette, bought a few months prior to death with a suspect amount of cash, the truck cab he used for his hauling business, repossessed by the leasing agency post-mortem, a ramshackle bungalow in the outskirts, also repoed by the bank post-mortem, and his young widow, a hash slinger at the Double R Diner, Shelley McCauley Johnson, known to you, I recall, as the girl I'd most like to take to the prom. By the way, forgive the stains on this page, writing this as I enjoy yet another delicious and oh-so-flaky chicken pot pie, third night in a row, from that same local quarter-star bistro, the greasy spoon you keep raving about with the pie and the coffee. Pardon me, Gordon, but on the whole, to quote William Claude Dukenfield, I'd rather be in Philadelphia where you are undoubtedly luxuriating at this very moment in your silk smoking jacket enjoying a fruity French Bordeaux with another one of your imported nieces. Sorry, trigger warning. Repeated and prolonged proximity to moribund logging communities set off my misanthropy. But indulge me long enough to offer a brief moment of sociological commentary. If the good folks of burgs like these would put down the remote and the beer or the bong and stay out of their off-road vehicles and duck blinds on weekends in order to punch the clock on some career counseling or community college, They might have a fighting chance to switch horses when the Turk comes to shutter their 19th century industrial meal ticket. Because the Turk is coming. The world is changing, pronto, Chief, and now that these salt-of-the-earth country folk realize they've been left behind, it's going to be sheer hell playing catch-up. I know, I'm a raging asshole. And speaking of entrepreneurial initiative, here's a no-brainer. Why don't some of these enterprising yokels kickstart a craft brewery here in town? They'd instantly attract an endless stream of thirsty proles, and the only competition is swill. Enough community building for one night. To sum up, Leo Johnson's dead, having a hard time arguing that the local landscape isn't trending upward because of it. Next case, save me a glass, you cosmopolitan swell. Albert. P.S. The recent body count from this little criminal corner of town is officially way off the actuarials. Jean Renault, Jacques Renault, Leo Johnson, and some other dirtbag drug dealer in the woods whose melodious name escapes me. When I brought this trend up to Sheriff Harry Truman, or as I like to call him, Chatty Cathy, he replied, "Well, makes my job a whole lot easier." Initial, A.R. Federal Bureau of Investigation, Case Number 008-072-0119. Bureau File Number TP, 1 of 18. Tamara Preston, Case Agent. Shelley Johnson, Confidential. At a glance, Shelley's story reads as depressingly familiar. The only child of a dysfunctional local marriage that ended in early divorce, exacerbated by alcoholism and repeated incidents of spousal abuse. Shelley lived with her mother after the split. Her father fled the state and disappeared, and Shelley left home for good at 17. While her Twin Peaks High School transcripts paint a portrait of a bright and promising student, she dropped out at the end of her junior year when Leo Johnson, 6 years her senior, suddenly careened into her life. My understanding is that you hold a personal fondness for Shelley, Chief, so I'm including a few more details here than I might have otherwise. According to a formal inquest conducted in the aftermath of Leo's death, these facts emerge. A covert relationship between Shelley and Laurel Palmer's putative boyfriend, Bobby Briggs, appears to have overlapped a large percentage of her nearly 2-year marriage to Leo. Corroborated testimony also suggests that this relationship with Bobby during high school predated Leo. Bobby and Shelley were, in fact, contemporaries who had known each other going all the way back to elementary school. One fellow student vividly recalled this. When Shelley realized Bobby was two-timing her with Laura, she confronted him in an angry public scene that disrupted the junior prom. She stormed out in her prom dress and, as fate would have it, decamped to a local adult venue known by its sign as the Bang Bang Bar, but more colloquially as the Roadhouse. Although she was underage at the time, a laissez-faire attitude toward the serving of underage patrons, it appears she knew the bartender on duty that night, resulted in Shelley downing a couple of beers before Leo Johnson, who had just rolled in from a road trip, intervened to gallantly procure for her a few more potent illicit cocktails, and before the night was over, one thing led to another. Cutting, as they say, to the chase, Leo and Shelley obtained the necessary paperwork and appeared before a local justice of the peace exactly 3 weeks later. The justice noted dryly in his remarks that the young couple stated they were celebrating their third anniversary and tied the knot. You might well ask, what could possibly go wrong? As we now know, everything that could did. Within a few weeks of Leo's passing, let's charitably call this the observation of a designated mourning period, Shelley and Bobby began to appear together around town in public places, clearly a couple again, joined in grief most assumed by the deaths of their respective former partners. I would, however, be remiss if I neglected to point out that, according to the case file, these two were also considered and subsequently cleared by law enforcement as prime suspects in Leo Johnson's murder. The emergence of at-large fugitive Wyndham Earle as the more probable culprit ultimately led investigators to conclude that, while evidence indicated they were far from blameless in Leo Johnson's downfall, Shelley and Bobby were, at best, not guilty and, at worst, seen as not likely to be successfully prosecuted. 1 year after Leo's death, almost to the day, perhaps Shelley had learned something from the dictum, "Marry in haste, repent in leisure," Bobby and Shelley were formally wed during a weekend getaway to Reno. Family did not attend. Their now legal union, within 7 months, timing that seems to have influenced this sudden decision to book a flight to Nevada, produced a daughter, Rebecca Macaulay Briggs. Shelley's estranged mother died that same year at 47, cirrhosis of the liver, But Bobby's mother, Betty, grieving the recent loss of her own husband, stepped up to the plate, devoting herself to providing her son and his new wife a stability they sorely needed for their new family. And as she had done since the day Shelley began working at the Double R, proprietor Norma Jennings, soon to lose her own hardened criminal husband Hank with far fewer regrets in a prison shanking, played the role of the surrogate mother that Shelley had always needed. Norma and Betty joined forces to co-sign a loan that allowed Bobby and Shelley to buy their first house. Within a year of Leo's death when she turned 21, Shelley now had a home, a husband she loved, a beautiful child, and a supportive circle of friends and customers at a job she adored. As the saying goes, it takes a diner to raise a child. Of all the personal stories I've now surveyed in Twin Peaks, Shelley seems one of the luckiest ones. But then, as you well know, Chief, most stories have more than one act. I'll return to this one, and to Deputy Briggs, presently. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP 2 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Horns and Haywards, confidential. During the same time frame, something curious and well under the radar occurred one night at the home of one of the town's most beloved citizens and its widely admired general practitioner, Dr. Will Hayward. I've assembled the following pieces of information I've been able to collate into the following scenario, which feels like the most reasonable explanation. The event in question appears to have happened on the same day as the explosion in the vault of Twin Peaks Savings and Loan, which, as you'll remember from the dossier, resulted in the deaths of Pete Martell, Andrew Packard, and the bank's assistant manager, Del Mibler. That evening, the incident's only living survivor, Ben Horn's 18-year-old daughter, Audrey, gravely injured in the explosion, was being treated in intensive care at Calhoun Memorial Hospital. A closer examination yielded the following 9 curiosities reported below. First curiosity. Also being treated for a serious head injury in the same ER that night was Audrey's father, Ben Horn. Horn had spent most of the day in the hospital at Audrey's bedside, but apparently left sometime after dark only to return as an urgent care patient a little over an hour later. Second curiosity, the admitting physician, who, it turns out, also drove Ben Horn to the hospital after his injury, was Dr. Will Hayward. The injury, according to Hayward's report, occurred at the Haywards' home, the result of a fall suffered when Horn, quoting the hospital admittance form, slipped on the hearth of the living room fireplace, hitting his head on the hard granite mantel. Hayward goes on to detail that Horn, despondent over his daughter's condition, had come to the house seeking counsel about his daughter's chances for recovery. Why this conversation never took place at the hospital, where both men spent most of the day together, is neither asked nor answered. After rapidly consuming a couple of drinks served by the doctor himself, Horn complained of feeling lightheaded and moments later collapsed in front of the Hayward fireplace. The doctor goes on to mention that he and Horn had been speaking privately at the time, so there were no other witnesses. Third curiosity. The only medical file I've been able to obtain from the hospital is brief, almost cursory, and was also written by Dr. Hayward. There was a reference to x-rays being taken, presumably to check for skull fractures, results negative, but I have been unable to find them. There was no mention of any other specific symptoms to support Dr. Hayward's diagnosis that Ben Horn had suffered a grade 2 concussion and his recommendation that he be held in the hospital overnight for observation. Horn was admitted to a room just down the hallway from the one occupied by his injured daughter. With everything else going on in town that day, the bank explosion, Agent Cooper's overnight disappearance and return, local law enforcement was stretched fairly thin, so it appears that no officials ever questioned the doctor's account of Ben Horn's injury. Fourth curiosity. We now know that the next morning, Doc Hayward accompanied Sheriff Truman to examine Agent Cooper in his room at the Great Northern Hotel after he returned from a mysterious night spent, exact whereabouts unknown, in the Ghostwood National Forest. While they were in the room, again according to Doc Hayward's subsequent report, Agent Cooper went to the bathroom to brush his teeth, slipped on the bathroom floor, and slammed his head into the mirror over the sink, knocking himself unconscious. Once again, Doc Hayward accompanied his patient to the hospital, this time Sheriff Truman drove, and admitted him with the same diagnosis, a grade 2 concussion. While they were there, according to the hospital log timeline, Ben Horn was discharged after being examined and cleared for release by the on-call doctor, not Doc Hayward, and was taken home by his brother Jerry. Fifth curiosity. Agent Cooper, according to available records, spent that day and night in the hospital before checking himself out without receiving medical clearance the following morning. Within 2 days, he would vanish from Twin Peaks and disappear from view for the next quarter of a century. We also know, from a report filed by Sheriff Frank Truman more than 25 years later, that at some point that day, while making his rounds, Doc Hayward saw Cooper in a hospital corridor, fully dressed in his usual black suit, exiting the room in the ICU occupied by Audrey Horn. Sixth curiosity. 9 months later, almost to the day, Audrey Horn gave birth to her son, Richard Horn. The birth certificate states the identity of the father as unknown. Seventh curiosity. Within 2 days, Agent Cooper had vanished, and Major Garland Briggs, reportedly the last person in town whom Cooper visited before his disappearance, had been declared dead after a fire at Listening Post Alpha, high up in the mountains of the Ghostwood Forest. Although the charred corpse found at the scene was too damaged to identify through then-relatively nascent DNA technology, the discovery of a few loose teeth, which matched Briggs' dental records, led to the conclusion that he had indeed died in the fire, the cause of which, the subsequent intensive Bureau investigation concluded, remains unknown. Eighth curiosity. Within 3 months of these apparently interrelated events, the following events occurred. After a lifetime spent in the state of Washington, without warning, Doc Hayward abruptly shuttered his thriving practice and moved all the way across the country to the town of Middlebury, Vermont. Shortly thereafter, Hayward and his wife Eileen, after 26 years of marriage, filed papers that finalized an uncontested and mutually agreed upon divorce. In that same month, their oldest daughter, Donna, just after graduating with honors from Twin Peaks High, also left town for good, settling in New York City. Her mother, still confined to a wheelchair after a car accident nearly 2 decades earlier, remained in the Hayward family's Twin Peaks home, where she raised their 2 younger daughters, Harriet and Gersten, alone. Ninth curiosity. I have identified a steady flow of income, $7,500 a month, into the bank account of Eileen Hayward. The payments began the month that Doc Hayward left town and persisted until Eileen's death from pneumonia in 2009. These appear to have been direct deposit wire transfers from an offshore account in the Cayman Islands. I have just traced that account to a Shell LLC corporation registered to the Horn Foundation. As of this writing, the foundation's principal, Benjamin Horn, responding through his attorney, has denied my repeated request for an interview on this subject. Since the filings were all made in accordance with existing law and there is no apparent appearance of a crime or corporate malfeasance, DOJ has declined to issue a subpoena to pursue this matter. My feeling, not entirely supported by fact, is that something untoward happened in the Hayward household that night when Benjamin Horn dropped in. The effects of this event seem to have devastated and effectively destroyed one of the community's most admired and respected families. Harriet seems to have suffered the fewest ill effects. After high school, she studied at the University of Washington, eventually becoming a pediatrician in the Bellevue area, a suburb of Seattle. Gersten, I'll return to in a moment. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP, 3 of 18. Case agent, Tamara Preston. Donna Hayward, confidential. Arriving in New York City in 1992, Donna Hayward began taking undergraduate classes at Hunter College. She had just turned 18. She supported herself by working as a model, eventually signing with the exclusive Ford Modeling Agency. All reports indicate that during this time, she cut off all communication with both her father and her mother, exchanging letters and occasional phone calls only with her younger sisters. She similarly cut off contact with all of her former friends in Twin Peaks, with one exception. A few years later, she exchanged 2 letters with Audrey Horn. I learned this from Donna herself, replying by written letter, not email, to my repeated inquiries to her. She was unwilling to share the letters with me or discuss any of their content. As her modeling career advanced, Donna dropped out of Hunter College after her freshman year. The job carried her to various foreign countries, and she worked in Paris, Milan, Monaco, and other fashion meccas. Within the industry, she was considered one of the fresh faces of the 90s. after the somewhat decadent previous decade, a return to a more wholesome all-American look perhaps best epitomized by Kathy Ireland. To be blunt, Donna had taken a hard left into the fast lane. During this time, she frequently appeared in the gossip and society columns of various New York newspapers, where she was linked romantically with a variety of high-profile men, a soap opera star, a professional tennis player, a nightclub magnate, and a minor and somewhat dissolute scion of a European royal family. Near the end of the decade, as she reached her late 20s and her modeling career slowed, Donna married a man nearly two decades her senior, the co-founder of a successful dot-com startup and a prominent figure in the New York venture capital community. If anything, this raised her social profile ever further, as the couple entertained frequently at their Sutton Place brownstone and their opulent beach house in Southampton. Just before the turn of the century, at an unspecified charity event on one of those weekends, Donna apparently encountered Lana Budding Milford, the widow of Twin Peaks Post publisher Douglas Milford. Both wearing couture and wide smiles, their photo ran on the society page of the New York Post. While Lana appears to beam, on closer examination, something around the edges of Donna's expression appears fraught with tension and dismay. Whether this encounter had any direct bearing on what happened next is impossible to determine, but Donna's fairy tale New York existence, polo, yachts, helicopters, the whole nine yards of garish material excess, unraveled shortly thereafter, exposing the reality of a much harsher inner life. 4 years into the marriage, Donna discreetly and at first voluntarily entered rehab for drug and alcohol dependence. This proved to be only the first of Donna's four stints in rehab over the next 5 years, the last of which, an involuntary stay at McLean Psychiatric Hospital in Massachusetts, was the result of an intervention. This final episode, in which she was reported missing by her husband, then found 2 days later in a Lower East Side crack house, appears to have been triggered by the death from heart failure of her mother Eileen, with whom Donna had never reconciled nor, as near as I can determine, spoken in the 17 years since her sudden departure from Twin Peaks. Donna did not attend the funeral. Shortly after her release from McLean, sober now but shaky, Donna's husband initiated divorce proceedings. Because she had signed an ironclad prenuptial agreement, Donna was awarded only a low six-figure lump sum and a modest monthly stipend. She soon moved into an apartment in a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut, far from the limelight in which she'd been living, where she rigorously attended local 12-step meetings and managed to hang on to her sobriety. Approaching 40 and facing an uncertain future, Donna at this point reached out to her father, Will Hayward, for the first time in more than 20 years. This contact, it seems, led to their reconciliation. Within a year, Donna had moved to the small college town of Middlebury, Vermont, where Will, now well into his 70s, was still practicing family medicine. Donna moved in with her father and began working as his assistant in his practice. Doc Hayward, in the past year, has quietly begun to wind down his daily hours, but says he intends to never fully retire. Donna remains by his side to this day, living a quiet life and very active as a sponsor in the local 12-step community. Although she politely rebuffed all of my attempts to speak to her directly, I've learned she is currently studying to obtain a degree as a nurse practitioner. I should mention that Donna's youngest sister, Gersten, has, if anything, suffered even more obvious ill effects from whatever events tore this family apart. Gersten was an exceptional child in many regards. A musical prodigy, she performed as a piano soloist in concert venues all across the Northwest while still in her early teens. She was also a prodigiously talented mathematician, taking college-level courses while still a high school freshman. She graduated from high school at 16 and was offered scholarships from a number of prominent universities. Able to speak and read four languages fluently, Gersten has been tested well above genius level in IQ. Throughout her childhood and teen years, her exceptionalism in so many disciplines appeared to function as a kind of shield from the turbulence and unhappiness that descended on her family. Once she entered Stanford University at 16, however, it quickly became apparent that the energy put into all of these high-stress, high-function abilities did not protect her from whatever trauma she'd suffered as a child, nor did it prepare her emotionally for the internal demands this more adult world was now placing on her. By the middle of her second semester, after exhibiting alarming symptoms of maladaptation to her new circumstances, Gersten suffered what was diagnosed as a severe nervous collapse and emotional breakdown. After 6 weeks of treatment in a Bay Area psychiatric hospital, she was released, withdrew from Stanford, and returned home to Twin Peaks to live with her mother. Gersten underwent immediate and ongoing psychiatric care, and her health improved, but sadly, her ability to cope with the trials of everyday living did not. Although doctors had prescribed for her a steady course of antidepressants as an ongoing protocol, during this period, Gersten privately turned to stronger street drugs for comfort, concurrent with the nationwide trend in dependence on opioids and designer synthetics. The death of her mother Eileen in 2009, by removing her protective influence and the social safety net Gersten had come to depend upon, appeared to derange her even further. This led her into a series of reckless and chaotic relationships with a number of men and women. The most damaging of these proved to be an off-again, on-again affair with one Stephen Burnett, an unstable career miscreant and low-level drug dealer in the Twin Peaks area, who had in the interim become her primary source for narcotics. This relationship preceded and apparently also overlapped Stephen's marriage to Rebecca Briggs, daughter of Shelley and Bobby Briggs. Now in her early 20s, Becky works at a bakery owned by Norma Jennings in downtown Twin Peaks. A warrant for Stephen Burnett was recently issued as a suspected accomplice in an international drug-running operation, he has gone missing, that prominently involved Audrey's son, Richard Horn, who is also still at large and wanted on, among other things, a hit-and-run warrant, and a crooked deputy in the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department, Chad Broxford, who is currently awaiting trial on a variety of charges. The timely intervention of her mother, Shelley, and her father, Deputy Sheriff Bobby Briggs, appears to have spared Becky any lasting legal trouble, but Gersten has not been seen since and is believed to have left the area. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP, 4 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Ben and Audrey Horn. Confidential. Nothing would please my longing for narrative closure more than to report that Audrey Horn's near-death experience at the bank resulted in a meaningful reconciliation with her father, Ben. Sadly, this does not appear to be the case. The unknown seismic shifts that led to the dissolution of the Hayward marriage appeared to cause a kind of bank-shot collateral damage to the Horn's 30-year union as well. Having already lived separate lives, by most accounts, for more than a decade, Ben and Sylvia Horn divorced within 2 years of the Hayward's dissolution. Both remained in the Twin Peaks area. Ben kept the old family house, and Sylvia moved across town to a McMansion in a gated, upscale housing development where she has ever since assumed sole custody and care of their special needs son, Johnny, a profound case of autism, who is now in his early 40s. Audrey awoke from the coma she'd been in as a result of the bank explosion after 3.5 weeks. She apparently retained no memory of the event itself, and at first seemed to be on her way to a complete recovery. Two events altered that trajectory. First was her father's decision to proceed with the sale of the Horn family's privately owned 350-acre parcel of the Ghostwood Forest, the sale Audrey had been protesting against when she went into the bank that morning, to a secretive investment capital group that immediately began construction of a privately owned and operated state prison on the site. Then Audrey discovered, 2 months after her release from the hospital, that she was pregnant. Audrey refused all offers of financial help from her father and mother, moved out of the family home and into a small apartment, and prepared, as she put it in a letter to her mother at the time, for the most important role of her life, raising her child as a single mother. Audrey had just turned 19 when her son Richard was born. She never returned to high school, completing her GED through independent study over the next 2 years. She then enrolled in classes at the local community college, studying economics and business administration. After obtaining her degree, she opened a local hair and beauty salon in the Twin Peaks area, which she has successfully owned and operated ever since. She had few friends outside of her customers and employees and largely kept to herself. She never commented publicly and was never heard to speculate with anyone about who the father of her son might be and didn't seem interested in discussing it with anyone. If Audrey herself was curious about the father's identity, she never availed herself of any easily obtained paternity tests that I've been able to uncover. One can conclude that she didn't care, or perhaps she knew who it was all along. The only possible clue I've been able to find along those lines is a framed photo of Agent Cooper that hangs on the wall of her office at the salon. True to her word, although her mother Sylvia played an important role as Richard's grandmother, Audrey raised the boy entirely on her own. She has apparently never allowed her son to meet his grandfather Ben. Circumstances changed after Richard's 10th birthday when, without warning, in a private civil ceremony, Audrey married her longtime accountant. Witnesses close to the situation suggest that this was more a marriage of financial convenience than affection. And during my research here, I've come across troubling accounts of public scenes, heavy drinking, verbal abuse, and sexual infidelity, all allegedly on the wife's part. The couple briefly consulted a marriage counselor, and Audrey apparently consulted her own mental health care professional during this time, but those files are sealed and inaccessible. 4 years ago, without warning, Audrey closed the salon. Not long after, she seemed to vanish from public life, into either agoraphobic seclusion or, one troubling rumor suggests, a private care facility. The Horn family spokesperson has refused to respond to all inquiries regarding her whereabouts. Ben Horn spends the majority of his time at the Great Northern Hotel, where he keeps a private suite for his personal use, but just as often sleeps in his office. He appears to spend as little time in the old nearby family manse as possible. His brother Jerry still resides in his own private wing there. Ben remains as active in his various businesses as ever, but since the sale of their portion of the Ghostwood Forest and the impact it had on his daughter's life, it seems clear that he has conducted his investments and purchases on a more readily apparent ethical footing. He also remains deeply troubled by the project that was eventually put up on the former Horn land in Ghostwood. The privately held and run prison opened there in 2001, a deeply controversial project not just in the town but region-wide. Owned through a shell company by an opaque consortium of conservative investors in the Midwest, this company has proved itself an absentee landlord in the worst sense of the word. An ugly, brutish structure built by lowball contractors to save money, the Ghostwood Correctional Facility is widely considered the ugliest object in this otherwise pristine valley. Ben Horn himself has on more than one occasion publicly referred to it as a blight on our land. While the prison has provided some low-wage, low-skill employment opportunities for many area workers displaced by the shuttering of the local logging industry, it is by all accounts dispiriting work for a company with little apparent regard for employee relations. When workers attempted to unionize in the early part of this century, the company simply refused to recognize their right to bargain collectively and threatened to bus in workers from out of state. The strategy proved effective and the employees backed down. The arrival of the prison coincided with a sharp rise within the local community in a number of medical issues. Alcoholism, depression, prescription opioid addiction and abuse, illegal trafficking and same, domestic violence, and suicide. A majority of those affected by these issues are prison employees and their families. A Twin Peaks Post editorial has referred to this ongoing tragedy as an epidemic. Interesting footnote. The chief administrator of Ghostwood Prison at this time, Warden Dwight Murphy, crossed our radar during the recent Blue Rose investigation. It may be worth our time to see if his subsequent murder related back in any way to his years at Ghostwood. My personal interview with Ben Horn at the Great Northern, which, surprisingly, he agreed to, revealed a man on the cusp of old age, rueful and filled with regrets for what he sees as his many failings. He openly claims to take full responsibility for the damage wrought upon his family and remains unwilling to blame anything or anyone but himself. He also seems moved by an urgent impulse to find a more spiritual direction for his life and mentioned that he's trying to spend more time out in nature than he's been accustomed to. My impression in this regard is that he feels the weight of narrowing time pressing down and seems eager to make amends. For all this, Ben Horn's chief regret, or at least one that he was willing to express to me personally, remains the sale of the family section of the Ghostwood Forest. Having paid a visit there recently, I can personally attest that Ghostwood Correctional Facility is more than just a befouling presence in the once pristine foothills of Blue Pine Mountain. Its long record of ignoring employee complaints places it in the lowest 10% among the burgeoning phenomenon of private prisons nationwide. Widespread reports of abuse and neglect toward its inmates place it even closer to rock bottom. I am also looking into rumors of alleged collusion between the prisoner's parent company and some regional police forces, not including, I hasten to add, the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department, to step up arrest rates and stiffen conviction recommendations on relatively minor offenses, in order to increase what is referred to in company literature as the prison's client population. As an aside, this is a potentially explosive issue that should concern any dedicated law enforcement personnel, one that I believe warrants our attention nationwide. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP, 5 of 18. Case agent, Tamara Preston. Jerry Horn, confidential. Ben's younger brother, Jerry Horn, his longtime junior partner in business, if not in crime, although Ben has faced accusations of malfeasance many times in the past, let it be stated for the record that neither man has ever come under any felony indictment, has chosen a distinctly different path in the past two decades. A lifelong bachelor, Jerry seems to have floated through his privileged existence without forming any lasting romantic attachments. A string of shorter, more ephemeral affairs of the heart he has amassed in abundance. He remains to this day an enthusiastic world traveler. He is conversationally adept in four languages and appears to have perpetually filled the role of advance man for the family business, bringing in deals from companies throughout the States and, indeed, the globe. Denmark, Finland, Brazil, Norway, France, and Morocco, to name just a few. In other words, Jerry roped him in, often lavishly hosting and entertaining clients at the Great Northern Hotel, often referred to in company PR as the crown jewel of the family's portfolio, where Ben assumed the more senior position of the closer. A word cloud analysis of news stories written about Ben's colorful younger brother over the years yields the following. Gadfly, cheerful, enthusiastic, restless, upbeat, good-natured, wild man, spontaneous, life of the party. You get the idea. Whether any of the Horns' many and varied business ventures ever actually originated with Jerry alone is hard to determine. With one notable exception. Over the past 10 years, Jerry has originated and pursued one new business venture that is, without a doubt, entirely the result of his own initiative. This operation also appears poised as a result of many rapidly changing social and legal conventions to become on paper the most massively successful endeavor in Horn Corp history. One may decide to credit Bohemian Jerry with no more than wishful thinking, but he did accurately anticipate the legalization of marijuana dawning in the state of Washington. More than that, he was, in fact, one of the movement's major donors and behind-the-scene organizers for many years before the official legislation finally passed in 2012. Anecdotally, it appears that motivation for his activism went well beyond the libertarian or fiduciary into the personal, by which I mean Jerry, according to a number of sources I've heard from, has been perpetually as high as an orbiting communication satellite since approximately 1969. For instance, just a small sample of the available confirming evidence. As a college student, Gonzaga, class of 68, Jerry drove cross-country to attend Woodstock in his own private, customized Airstream trailer. He appears briefly in the Oscar-winning documentary of that landmark concert, literally emerging from the Airstream with a bevy of nubile hippie chicks and a cloud of smoke. He was for years a known associate of renowned Oregon-based author Ken Kesey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a notorious libertine and 60s-style consciousness-raising advocate, as a member of his ragtag entourage of followers, known collectively as the Merry Pranksters. A title which, come to think of it, is as concise a distillation of Jerry Horn's essence as I could hope to express. For example, Jerry once attempted to obtain a medical license for marijuana use, years before it became legal for that purpose, in order to treat his addiction to marijuana. Because he acted with uncharacteristic discipline and focus, Jerry's preparation meshed perfectly with opportunity, resulting in Washington State's most successful domestic cannabis production outfit in, pardon the phrase, Chief, a highly competitive and tightly regulated business environment. Jerry had privately dabbled for decades as an amateur botanist, growing your own, as they say, in the medicinal community, and since legalization has personally developed more than a dozen distinct Frankenstein strains and hybrids of alarming potency. Among his most popular, to illustrate the point, whose hands are these? Collateral damage, and the center will not hold. The net effect of this has made his products among the most sought after in the marketplace, and a recent announcement that he has plans to open a string of brick-and-mortar retail shops, name TBD, but among the domain names he has already reserved, ahighercalling.com, 8mileshigh.com, and upupandaway.com, indicates he's positioning the operation for a move into the regional and, they hope, national market as cannabis laws grow progressively less prohibitive. Jerry has undoubtedly mellowed with time and age, an effect that shouldn't surprise, given that by this point he must have stockpiled levels of THC in his system that could preserve a woolly mammoth. He remains, as he has always been, a loner by nature, given to long stretches wandering in the nearby wilderness. His only friend outside of the Horn family appears to be Dr.